And now it's time for a special edition of Josh's Library Corner. All right, Josh, today we've got a very special book, and it's not your usual true crime pick. It is a new release from Kensington Books by author Dandy Smith called The Wedding Vow. I know, Josh, that you've not yet finished the book, but what can you share with our listeners as to why they should check out The Wedding Vow and why it's the perfect spring-summer read?
Well, I'm only 50 pages into the book, but the gist of the story is that Verity, the founder of a wellness brand, has been married to Lyndon for 5 years. And when Lyndon is murdered and his secrets start to reveal themselves, it leaves Verity with a lot more questions and pain than answers. You know how we joke about throwing away our computers and dumping out our nightstands when we die?
Oh, yes.
Well, Lyndon didn't have that plan, and it turns out that he was hiding some not-so-good stuff under a floorboard.
Ooh.
That's the point I just reached in the book.
That's juicy.
The Wedding Vow really hits on the fear of whether or not you can really ever know somebody, even if it's your spouse. We made wedding vows.
We did.
And we don't know each other at all.
Not even a little.
We have so many floorboards, so many secrets.
That is genuinely a fear of mine.
And I'm a little worried that she may not make it through before becoming a victim herself.
Wow. That's quite the tease. If you enjoy a domestic suspense thriller where nothing is quite as it seems, The Wedding Vow has everything you'd expect and so much you wouldn't. The Wedding Vow is packed with tension, deception, and the kind of twists that make you stop and go, oh, okay, so everyone here is just going to make the worst choices. The Wedding Vow by Dandy Smith is available now wherever books are sold. When multiple young women were found slain within days of each other in 1978, not much fuss was made as they were simply labeled as prostitutes. If these stories had made more than a blip in local reporting, there might have been talks of a serial killer being on the loose, tormenting sex workers. But what's scarier? One man taking out multiple women or multiple men killing women as they please? Today, I'll be discussing the cases of Antoinette Carter, Diana Kuhn, and Lisa McCauley. How does that phrase go? Something like, you make plans while God is laughing at you? That's pretty much the theme for this episode. I've been wanting to share as much as possible about the unsolved murder of Antoinette Carter, but there's been an issue with the records. I thought the story of Diana Kuhn would require an entirely separate episode. That wasn't the case. I had hoped to have an interview with a sex worker, but that fell through also. So we're going to move forward with the information because we have these stories, and as much as they can be, they deserve to be told. As I said in the Knife Freak episode, which was just a handful of episodes back, regarding the murder of Shelley Sabo, these stories came about while I was researching another case, and I saw two sex workers had been brutally murdered within just days of one another. First was Shelley, the focus of that episode. She was stabbed no less than 15 times, killed by a truck driver while she was working. Her killer, Dennis Dean Kersting, was sentenced to life in prison. Thankfully, Shelley's case was solved due to a concerned citizen who saw a suspicious situation and reported it. Shelley had been killed on November 26th. 10 days later, 22-year-old Antoinette Carter was added to the list. My records request for information about Antoinette, or Tony's, case was denied as her case remains unsolved, so it's technically open. I know I am not owed anything, so settle down, commoners, but I can't even put into words how frustrating it is to reach out to a cold case unit about, you know, a cold case, only to be ignored. And it's not because I'm being ignored. It's not like my feelings are hurt, but it's because there's only so much you can do with a nearly 50-year-old case, and sharing information with the public is the most helpful. So it's not that they're ignoring me. It feels like they're ignoring Antoinette. On Friday, December 8th, 1978, a column on the front corner of the Metro section of the Oregonian had a headline that read, "Second prostitute slain in Portland in 11 days." Minnie L. Jones was born in the town that sounds as quaint as it does racist, Sunflower, Mississippi, in 1934. That state combined with that year, yikes. She had four older siblings, two younger. When she was 16, the family moved to Niven, Arkansas. Sometime between 1950 and 1956, Minnie made it out of the South and into the Pacific Northwest. Her daughter, Antoinette, who went by Toni, was born May 6th, 1956. Again, with another totally accidental calendar-related moment of kismet, this episode is being released one day before what would have been Toni's 70th birthday. Growing up in Portland with four siblings, I'm not sure older or younger, or if they were living with her, Toni eventually attended Jefferson High School in North Portland. While there, she participated in home ec, she was on the girls' track team, and in her junior year, she was the vice president of the student class. Pictures are worth a thousand words, but they can only tell so much. So while I was happy to find photos of Toni in her yearbooks, all they show me is that she had friends and amazing style. Okay, the fashion, the hair, the accessories. And we'll have all those pictures of Toni on our blog about this episode. What the pictures don't tell me is what her life was like before high school. They don't tell me what kind of relationship she had with the man that she was impregnated by. I assume early in her senior year. I don't know what kind of relationship she had with her family or how they felt about her being a teen mother to her son, Tori. Her beautiful smile doesn't tell me the circumstances that led to her doing sex work. We can fill in the blanks, knowing how hard life is in general, compounded with being a woman of color in 1970s Portland who was also a teen mother, and it doesn't seem like much of a stretch to think that she did what she needed to do to keep her son fed and happy. 2 miles from Toni's home and 35 blocks from where 19-year-old Shelley Sabo's body was found 11 days earlier, Julia and Lloyd Melcher were leaving their home in the 3800 block of Northeast 20th Avenue in the Northeast Portland Alameda neighborhood. Julia got into her husband's truck, which she was using to drive him to his job as a garbage man. As they pulled out of the driveway and into the street, something caught her attention. At first, Julia thought a young boy was lying in the gutter in front of their home. She immediately pulled back into the driveway, went inside, and called the police. They stayed away from the body. She could tell right away that whoever was lying there was not alive, and it was unnerving. Thinking back to the night before, Julia remembered their white poodle barking at about 4 a.m. She and Lloyd ignored the dog and went back to sleep. Now it seemed to have been warning them of the danger happening outside their home. Police arrived to find that it was not a young boy lying in the gutter, it was a young woman. She was lying face down in the water-laden gutter. One arm was across the gutter, the other hung on the curb. She was wearing a purple dress and knee-high boots. Her dress had been pushed up above her waist. As the body, which had no ID on it, was taken in for an autopsy, police took photographs of the woman to local sex workers. They were the ones who confirmed it to be the body of 22-year-old Antoinette Carter. The mother of 5-year-old Tori had only been dead a short while before being discovered. While the body had superficial wounds, it was the stab to her heart that ended her short life. It's not surprising the discovery of a body in essentially her front yard would be shocking to Julia. It would be shocking to anyone. It was especially out of place in the quiet, two-laned suburb. Hers was a neighborhood known for birch trees and cute homes, not dead bodies lying in the street. Newspapers ran short stories about the discovery. Without witnesses or evidence, there wasn't much that could be asked of the community, though I don't think it was helpful to start the article not with Antoinette's name, but, quote, a 22-year-old Portland woman with an extensive police record for prostitution was slain early Thursday. Her body was found in a street gutter in a Northeast Portland residential area. Instead of asking for help or tips in the article about these dead prostitutes, police decided to educate the public, sharing that prostitution is dangerous. Besides the known murders, two other sex workers reported to police they had been raped when they attempted to leave their pimps, or as we say now, traffickers. No follow-up was reported to know if any of the officers actually arrested anyone for those rapes. Besides the worst outcomes, like murder and rape, sex workers are often victims of physical assaults, sometimes for not meeting quotas, sometimes for trying to leave, at least according to Mike Wiebe with Portland Police Department Vice. When talking about why sex workers don't report all incidents, he claimed it was due to a prostitute's, quote, strange sense of loyalty. Mm-hmm. Certainly not because she knows that you won't do anything, or maybe won't even believe her or treat her as less than because of what she does, or even arrest her for her crimes. But sure, Mike, loyalty. Throughout the years, we've discussed the ripple effect of the loss of a loved one to violence many, many times. And Tony's case is no exception. While there isn't much available about who she was or her case, I do know what happened to her son, Tori. Now, stick with me. I know this is like a bit of a tangent, but this is Tori, Tony's son. I don't know who Tori ended up living with after his mother was murdered when he was just 5, but it appears he remained in the Alameda neighborhood in Northeast Portland. For some background, Alameda was established in 1859 as a residential-only area, and you won't believe it, only whites were allowed to build or live there, even though the Chinook village of Nirchokiku was located just north of the neighborhood. One brochure that was touting the upcoming developments read, "No people of undesirable colors and kinds." Though North Portland went through an economic slump in the mid-20th century and racist restrictions expired and redlining forced people of color into the area, Alameda remained overwhelmingly white. In 2010, the census showed that of the 5,000 residents, 94% were white. 2020 didn't show much difference. If you're a fan of local hero Elliott Smith, you may know the neighborhood thanks to his song, Alameda. You walk down Alameda, looking at the cracks in the sidewalk, thinking about your friends. Knowing Tori experienced such a horrible, life-altering loss at such a young age, it should come as no surprise to learn that he had his own legal struggles. From 1989 to 1993, Tori committed at least 39 infractions, most of which were related to operating a vehicle. Things started to get dicier for Tori as he got older. He was charged with a minor in possession of liquor and an open container in a vehicle. Things only got worse when he was charged with disorderly conduct and assault in the fourth degree. Just like with his mother, we have to fill in the blanks of his life. He went to the same high school she did, Jefferson, where he played on the freshman basketball team. Later in his high school career, he would be awarded MVP in football, basketball, and baseball, all in the same year. While the neighborhood where his mother's body was found was mostly white, Jefferson High School was the opposite. In the 2009-2010 school year, it was the only school in the state of Oregon to have a majority of Black students. In 2018, not only did 84% of seniors graduate, which is 4% higher than the state average, but the student makeup was 1% Indigenous, 2% Hawaiian, 2% Asian, 10% mixed, 17% Hispanic, 28% white or non-Latino, and 41% Black. Growing up, Tori sang in the Paradise Baptist Church choir. His uncle, Vernell, was a minister. He was talented, well-known, and loved. Besides losing his mother, I've not seen anything about who his father was. While family members may have tried their best, the neighborhood and several family members were involved in local gangs, which Tori eventually also became involved in. By the time Tori was in his teens, he wasn't casually involved in gang activity. He was known as a charismatic leader in the local faction called the Woodland Park Bloods. In December 1992, Tori was living in a home with extended family members, including aunts, uncles, and cousins. When a rival gang learned of his address, they paid a visit. In the late hours of Wednesday, December 2nd, 1992, Tori's 9-year-old nephew, Dura, couldn't sleep, so he went to the living room hoping the couch would help him to catch some Z's. Around 1 a.m., Dura was awoken by a jarring noise. It was the sound of a breaking window and gunfire, lots of it, coming into the house. After hearing what he thought was about 10 shots, he ran to his family members. It wasn't until he was in the hallway that he realized he had been struck by one of those bullets. Which, seeing as detectives found there had been at least 30 shots taken at the house, it seemed like a miracle no one else was hit and Dura wasn't killed. Dura was taken to the hospital in fair condition, where doctors placed a plate in his left leg after a bullet shattered his thigh bone. Dura was eventually released, and he went back to being one of the top students at Woodland School. He was also a recipient of the I Have a Dream program, which would allow him to access a special college scholarship once he graduated high school. At 9 years old, Dura said he hoped to major in business while earning a living as a basketball player. He also wanted to run a restaurant that served comfort foods like mac and cheese and soup. And I would like to go to a restaurant like that. Even at a young age, Dura said in a statement to the unknown shooters, quote, "Stop it. I want to live as long as I can." That message was not received. Tori continued to play an important role in the local Bloods until Saturday, August 8, 1993. At 5 a.m., a discovery was made that was eerily similar to the circumstances surrounding his mother's death. Police were patrolling the area of the 5200 block of Northeast Cleveland Avenue, which is bordered by the I-5, Killingsworth, Alberta, and MLK. As the officers passed, they spotted a man lying in front of a duplex. Stopping to check on the situation, it was found the man had been shot in the chest. He was transported to Emmanuel Hospital, where he sadly passed away. That man was 19-year-old Tori Antone Carter. Like his mother, who had the nickname of Tony, Tori was known as Notorious or No Toes. And sadly, like his mother, he was left to die in the street. Officers questioned people in the area and learned that arguing between several people had occurred in the early morning hours, followed by gunfire. Witnesses then saw at least one involved party flee on a mountain bike. Tori's vehicle was found in the area, as was a bike, though it wasn't clear if that bike was involved in the getaway. Tori's car was processed for fingerprints. Later that same day, the intersection of Northeast 13th Avenue and Emerson Street, near Alberta Park in North Portland, was blocked off by 50 members of the Bloods. Chief Charles Moose and his officers happened to be in the area. And we're going to give a good police bell here, as they didn't incite violence or arrest anyone. Instead, they went into the crowd. They spoke with the leaders and listened as they were told how hard the loss of Tori was for everyone. The officers even offered understanding and sympathy. Ding, ding. Before an arrest could be made, another shooting took place, which was believed to be connected to Tori. It was 4 p.m., 11 hours after Tori was found, when more gunfire broke out in the 4500 block of North Vancouver Avenue in North Portland. A 16-year-old boy was shot in the leg, much like the situation with Dura a year earlier. In this case, though, a suspect was arrested. 18-year-old Lamond David Carter. It's unclear if he just happened to have the same last name as Tori or if he was indeed related to him. Lamont was charged with 2 counts of attempted murder and 2 counts of unlawful possession of a weapon. He pleaded guilty to second-degree assault. Detectives eventually caught Tori's killer, Larry Nobles. He was only 20 years old, but on probation for a jewelry store robbery, among other charges. He pleaded no contest to the charge of murder and was sentenced to 12 years. In a surprising twist, it didn't appear the shooting was related to the fact that Tori was involved with the Bloods and that Larry was a member of the Crips. Instead, Larry was leaving the home of a girl who had previously dated Tori. Around 4:30 a.m., Tori arrived at that location and the guys got into a physical altercation. The fight moved down the street before a gun became involved and Tori was shot. Tori's funeral was in the papers as most mourners paid respect by wearing colors, red specifically. Tori wasn't just a gang leader. He was charming, engaging, and well-known. Local police and outreach workers took the opportunity to try to help the teens in the area. A curfew was put into place and anyone under 17 was picked up and parents would have to go get them from the police station. In a more helpful and meaningful move, the gang enforcement team, community resource workers, and police officers, including Chief Moose, pooled their money and were able to gather enough food to hold an impromptu picnic in the park, hosting a meal and a game of basketball between the enforcement team and the teens in red. There was hope that the combination of that goodwill and the despair brought on by the loss of another young loved one would lead to better choices between the gangs. Unfortunately, the bliss was short-lived, and the devastation in the Carter family did not end there. 20 years after he was accidentally shot in the leg when Tori was the presumed target, Dura wound up becoming involved in the Bloods, as his uncle had. So yes, yeah, so we've got Tony, who was the sex worker killed in 78, her son Tori, he's shot and killed in 93. Now we're jumping to 2013, and this is Tori's cousin, Tony's nephew. On November 9th, 2013, a large event was held at the nightclub Fountain Bleu, which has since closed. That night, both the Hoover and Blood gangs were present, and it seemed the two gangs were getting along and there wasn't much of a rivalry happening. but something triggered a fight in the club, which led to chairs being thrown. With that, the owner of the club, Rodney DeWalt, ordered everyone to get out. The intersection of Northeast 3rd and Broadway was instantly filled with a crowd of about 100 people. Just like in Tori's case, the fight escalated when a gun became involved, and soon shots were ringing out, sending the crowd into a panic. The scene was so chaotic when the first responding officers arrived that they called in a code 3, meaning all available officers were asked to respond with lights and sirens. Once things were calmer, it was found that two people had been injured by gunshots. Dura had been hit 3 times in the chest and did not survive. No one heeded his desire to live as long as he could without gun violence. An investigation took place which led to the discovery of a gun in a parked car. A fingerprint was found on a bullet in the chamber, which matched 26-year-old Xavier Bolden. Xavier Bolden was injured just a month earlier in a gang shooting at the Portland Spirit, which is our local riverboat cruise. You know, they host 80s night and fancy dinners and dance parties, so on and so forth. So it was possible the shooting at the nightclub was retaliation for that shooting. Police also believe the subsequent shootings were continued retaliation that just goes on and on and on. And I know I could probably spend the rest of my life connecting all of these shootings, but I'm going to stop with Antoinette's family for now.
It's a cycle and a chain.
It's a cycle. And it's like, whether it's, you know, the Sopranos in the mafia or a kid on the streets in a gang, it's always just tit for tat. And somebody has to be the one to be like, keep that tit. I'm not tatting.
You keep your tits, I'll keep my tats.
Exactly.
And we don't have to do this.
Yeah. It's heartbreaking. Xavier fled to Las Vegas, where he was eventually picked up after a grand jury indicted him on 1 count of murder, 6 counts of attempted aggravated murder with a firearm, 1 count of first-degree assault, 1 count of second-degree assault, and 3 counts of unlawful use of a weapon. Yikes, that's a lot.
And just the opposite side of the coin, that this person's family as well, this person's loved one is, mm-hmm. as well, are being affected in a different way. But
oh, you're saying from the shooter's side?
Yeah. That's the same thing. That's going to have the same mm-hmm. ripple effect for years and generations.
And now my dad's in prison, so the only family that I can connect with is this gang, and they're going to take care of me because they're taking care of my dad. And now I'm in it, and now I kind of owe them this thing, and it's also all I know. So it's a comfort, safe space, even though it's not safe.
For me, it starts at the beginning of your story with the way her death was covered.
Mm-hmm.
Putting in that information.
That, to me, when it's reported that way, is not much different. It's obviously not the physical act, but it definitely adds salt to the wound of you are throwing her to the trash as much as that person did. You are treating her with just as much disregard.
The headline might as well be Hooker Gets Herself Killed.
Mm-hmm. She had it coming. Luckily, you're safe because you don't do these bad things. And he's a 5-year-old and his family's involved in all of this. And that's not his fault. That's not their fault. They're all just, everyone's trying to survive out here, man. And then that's what happens to your mom. And it's like, I can only imagine, because I have been bugging people for about 6 months to get even like a detective's name for this case. Don't email me bullshitting that you're working on it. What are you working on? Truly, what do you have that you've worked on recently? So I know no one followed through on that little boy to make sure he was okay, to promise him, we're going to find who did this to your mother. That never happened. There's no way that happened. Looking at her high school pictures, and she's just, I don't want to reduce it to like beauty, but there is a beauty with her. And she's just so cool looking and fun. And she's got these pictures where friends are kind of like, they look like they're falling over on her laughing. And she's got this straight face, like she knows she just got them with something hilarious, right? It's like she's a fucking person. And you, the dude who did it threw her in the trash, and the reporters threw her in the trash, and the fucking cops threw her in the trash. And it shouldn't be up to someone like me who's not a professional, who's not a detective, to try to get her story out there. A cold case detective should not ignore an email, should be able to say, hey, if you could say this and that, because boy, we would love to have a fucking piece of anything to work with. And then because nothing happened and nothing was solved and no more violence was taken off the street, the man who did this, the other violence continues. And then her son and nephew are murdered. If you've ever visited our blog at murderintherain.com, you have seen that most of our sources come from newspapers.com. The extensive collection of old newspapers at newspapers.com provides a treasure trove of historical crime reporting, offering a unique perspective on unresolved cold cases and forgotten mysteries. By utilizing newspapers.com's powerful search tools and advanced filters, true crime enthusiasts can uncover new leads, previously unnoticed details, and overlooked connections in old crime stories. The ability to access digitized newspapers from various time periods and regions allows researchers to gain a deeper understanding of the social, cultural, and political context surrounding a particular crime, offering valuable insights into the motives and circumstances of the case. Newspapers.com's vast archive of articles, obituaries, editorials, and letters to the editor can help true crime podcast hosts piece together a comprehensive narrative of a criminal case, shedding light on both the victims and perpetrators involved. By cross-referencing information from multiple newspapers and articles on newspapers.com, researchers can verify facts, corroborate witness statements, and identify discrepancies in news coverage, ultimately adding a layer of credibility and accuracy to their true crime investigations. The convenience of accessing newspapers.com's digitized library from anywhere with an internet connection allows true crime enthusiasts to conduct in-depth research and analysis on the go, enabling them to uncover compelling stories and insights that may have been previously hidden in the archives. To get started on your own newspapers.com journey, go to newspapers.com/crime. When you sign up, use discount code MURDERINTHERAIN to get 20% off. A big part of the state's case against Xavier relied on a former classmate of his who claimed to have witnessed the shooting. The defense took issue with this as she did not say anything about it until months later. The state argued back that there was no motive for her to have been dishonest. According to that witness, shortly before the trial began, her close friend had been shot to death. This led to her realizing just how important it was for her to come forward with that information. On March 23, 2017, a jury convicted Xavier of murder and a judge sentenced him to life with a 25-year minimum. The Fontainebleau never reopened after the night of the shooting, and it led to a civil lawsuit from Rodney DeWalt against the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and the City of Portland. He did this because his liquor license had been revoked after the shooting. This was on top of a history of hyper-focus on his venue and comments made by a city worker about how the people in line outside of the club looked, quote, lewd, vulgar, and filthy. Rodney didn't understand why his license was revoked, as there were other places with many more violent incidents that had not had their licenses affected. Sorry that this is really locals only, but for example, the Copper Penny. I know I don't really need to say more about that, but I'll give you a little bit. The Copper Penny was a place mostly for white folks to supposedly have a good time. I think I went once many, many years ago.
Was it the new Copper Penny then?
That it might have been the new Copper Penny at that point, but it was still not for me. Did you ever go?
No, I was told that it was a scary place not to really go there. I think there have been some shootings.
Well, in 2 years, like in a 2 year span.
Which 2 year span?
I don't have those exact years, but this was in the early 2000s. So you could say like from 2010 to 2012, something like that. There were 136 calls to the police from the Copper Penny. They also had multiple lethal and non-lethal shootings, yet their licensure was never affected. And a federal judge dismissed that case. So the Fontainebleau stayed closed. Tony and Shelley's murders were connected, but in coincidence only. They were both sex workers. They were young women who had been stabbed to death in early morning hours, their bodies discarded in North and Northeast Portland. Shelley's killer was caught thanks to a witness. Since Tony was killed after he was arrested, he wasn't responsible for her death. So who was? If you know anything about Antoinette Tony Carter's case, or maybe you went to school with her at Jefferson High and you can share information about who she was, we always love to share that with people. So please feel free to Gmail us. murderintherain@gmail.com. But if you know something about her murder, you are asked to contact the Portland Police Bureau at 503-823-5700.
But honestly, if you give us the information first, we'll get more done with it.
No kidding. I know. I always feel so conflicted, like True Crime Tuesday or this, where it's like, well, the police totally screwed it up and they didn't care and they aren't actually doing any work on it. Please call them with your information. It was the afternoon of December 10th when two young boys were riding their bikes through Mary S. Young Park in West Lynn, which is about 20 miles south of Portland. The park is usually a place for people to enjoy the over 100 acres of forests, hiking trails, and Willamette River frontage. On that Sunday, the park became a crime scene when those boys came across the partially dressed body of a young woman. Police arrived to find the body in a wooded area, but it was only 150 feet from the parking lot. She was lying atop her coat, wearing only socks and shoes. Her sweater was pulled up to cover her face, and her bra was near her body. A purse was at the scene, which contained only a library and social security card. The problem was that neither of those had a photo, so they couldn't positively identify her. The body was taken in to be examined. It was believed the victim had been dead for somewhere between 12 and 15 hours when discovered. The cause of death was strangulation. The ligature was her bra. The woman was eventually identified as 20-year-old Diana Marie Kuhn. She had attended Milwaukee and Marshall High Schools until her sophomore year when she dropped out. When she was 17, she moved out of the family home she shared with her two older sisters, one younger sister, and her parents. It wasn't clear why she left, but she said she wanted to be out on her own. Her father was worried as she was, quote, too easygoing, in his opinion. Her sister Debbie said Diana was quiet, friendly, but not outgoing. She never carried identification, which is why it was a difficult task to identify her. Debbie and Diana had last seen each other the Thursday before her body was found in the park. During that time, they chatted about friends and everything seemed fine. Diana was close with her family, contrary to what her moving out at 17 years old might imply. It took a few days, but police eventually quelled rumors surrounding Diana's death by releasing a statement that no police agencies or anyone familiar with Diana had a record of her being a sex worker. I think that idea came about because her murder was so close to the times of Shelley and Tony's deaths, and Diana had worked at a motel, and she was really young, so it could be an easy assumption for a member of the public to make. Investigators then looked at creating a timeline of the last days of Diana's life. She had been working as a housekeeper at the Chumaree Motor Inn on 82nd Avenue for the previous 8 months. Interviewing her boss, he told police Diana was quiet. No one really knew her, and she didn't communicate with anyone. But she was one of the hardest workers who always went the extra mile and was one of the, quote, neatest he had. On Thursday the 6th, Diana left work at the motel at 2:45 p.m., She met up with a friend and did some window shopping at Eastport Plaza, which is a large shopping center in that part of town. An hour later, that friend got on a bus, and that was the last time Diana was seen alive. I'm not sure when Diana met with her sister, because that is the same day. I would have thought it would have been that afternoon, but either way, whatever that day looked like, no one saw her again until her body was discovered on that Sunday. When last seen, Diana was wearing a multicolored sweater, brown shoes, beige corduroy pants, a knee-length maroon coat with white fur trim, and was carrying a black purse, which also sounds like the coolest 70s outfit one could possibly imagine.
I love that.
As the pieces started to come together, detectives felt whoever had done this to Diana had come into contact with her via hitchhiking, which was a common way for her to get to her home, which was only about a mile and a half from the motel. Interviews continued. In the first few weeks, police spoke to 50 people and felt they were only about halfway through their list. It was learned Diana did not frequent the park where she was found, so it wasn't believed she had been attacked while strolling or anything along those lines. More information showed she hadn't been dead for 12 hours. Her time of death was now up to possibly 2 days. As the days went on and little to no progress was made in her case, the articles sharing details got smaller and further back in the paper. Once it was ruled out that she had not been a sex worker, Diana's murder was connected to that of Marjorie Ann Furnett, which is a cold case I have been trying to get information about for something like 3 or 4 years. I've been told that the case is active, but the PR guy won't even give me enough information to do a True Crime Tuesday on her story, which is literally a minute long. We've covered a lot of stories here today, so I'm going to save Marjorie for another day when I can actually share something. But all of that is to say, they disconnected Diana from Tony and Shelley and looked at a possible connection to Margie. Margie's case does remain unsolved. I'm not sure what they have for evidence, if it can ever be literally connected to Diana's case, but that's for another day. The calendar rolled over from 1978 to 79. In January, there was hope for a new connection. In mid-January, 68-year-old Matilda Strong was found dead in her home. Unlike the youthful Diana, Matilda had survived polio and was a bit of a recluse. She required assistance to leave her home, but that was kind of where the differences ended. What gave investigators hope that these were connected was that both victims were strangled, Diana with her bra, Matilda with hands, and possibly an unknown ligature, which may have been the piece of fabric that was found by her body. There was no conclusive evidence either woman had been sexually assaulted, and both had valuables that were left undisturbed. Both women had bruising on their faces, and they lived within 1 mile of each other. A month later, an officer who was investigating burglaries in the area spotted a vehicle that contained items connected to Matilda's case. Although it had appeared nothing valuable had been taken, there was, in fact, a burglary in her home. 20-year-old John Wayne Quinn, who lived a block from Matilda and was the owner of the vehicle containing the stolen property, got incredibly drunk the night of the murder. He broke into Matilda's home with the intention of burglarizing it. As he was doing so, she appeared and it startled him. He punched her in the throat. Once she was down, he manually strangled her. The reason she didn't show any sign of rape was because he had done that after she was killed, so there were no injuries. In a separate case, John Wayne Quinn pleaded guilty to first-degree robbery. He had a long record of burglaries, many of which involved him taking women's underwear.
Well, I'm so sorry to jump in.
Please do.
I see. Uh-huh. Let me mind hunt this man.
Yes. So we're starting Lord. With underwear and then we're getting into.
Yep.
And also, I mean, that maybe was his first time going that far with someone, murdering and raping. In the case of Matilda, his first sentence was for death. That was later overturned and he was given life without parole for 25 years. An appeal overturned that sentence. And in 1981, John was given a sentence of life with no guaranteed minimum, meaning the parole board did not have to wait those 25 years to decide to let him out. And, you know, they were just chomping at the bit to get to do that. Ooh, let us let that guy out.
Ooh, that's why I joined the parole board. I like to let him out before they need to come out.
Oh, no minimum. Yes. So how long did he serve?
3 years.
John Wayne Quinn remains behind bars at the Oregon State Penitentiary.
Wow.
Can you believe it?
No.
Yeah, he's still rotting away.
Well, good.
I know. I couldn't believe I saw that without the minimum. And I was like looking for John Wayne Quinn released, sentence, change, anything. And then I was like, I'm going to do the inmate search. And boom, there he was. I could not believe it.
He sounds dangerous. That he would be a continued danger.
Yes, absolutely.
Especially if he's not getting any help.
That
probably
too.
Probably not.
So there were some similarities between what John did to Matilda, but he couldn't be connected to what had happened to Diana. Then time started to pass faster and faster. Before Diana's family knew, years became decades, and they were never closer to finding out who killed her. In 2025, 47 years after her murder, a cold case team reviewed the case file for Diana. Nicole Headley, a West Lynn Police Department property and evidence tech, and WLPD Detective Sergeant Todd Gradwall decided to start from scratch and looked at the case from the beginning at the request of a family member of Diana's. Going through the hundreds of documents, photos, and 5 evidence boxes, they searched for any hint that would guide them toward a piece of evidence that could possibly be tested with today's technology. And we're going to give another good officer bell here. Nicole said that they were able to do the work they did because of how well the scene was processed back in 1978. The evidence was collected properly and stored so well that nothing deteriorated.
Yeah, they'd sort of refined their method, I believe. So they had rape advocates. They were taking better reports and kind of dealing with things a little more responsibly.
Yeah, and they said that by that time they were kind of recognizing technology was coming into play and they were starting to collect things with that in mind, with the goal of maybe someday. So it actually worked. Ding, ding. Just like Matilda's case, it was decided that actually Diana had been sexually assaulted. They realized DNA remained on the coat that Diana had been wearing and was then laid on top of.
Hot damn!
I know, and I can only assume it was ejaculate, and it could now be tested. Another bell for police work here. This is like a record we're going for. As they interviewed dozens of people back in 78, there were three possible suspects that detectives had taken hair samples from just in case. In 2025, those hair samples were tested against the sample from Diana's coat, and out of those three, there was a match. David Lawrence Atkinson. The reason David was interviewed back in the day was that a witness who lived by the park had seen a man sitting in his car around the time of the murder. She had also seen him there before and knew something was up. Police questioned him and took the hair sample, but without DNA, there was no proof and he could not be charged. David Lawrence Atkinson was 32 years old at the time of Diana's murder. Just a few months before her death, he had been charged with rape and public indecency. I couldn't find what came of that charge, but he was obviously out in the world that November when Diana was murdered. In 1981, he filed a complaint against the Oregon State Penitentiary for the denial of effective counsel, and that was denied. The testing in 2025 delivered a name, but sadly, it could not deliver justice. David Lawrence Atkinson died in 1989. All that can be assumed is that after work on Thursday, or maybe to go out on Friday or Saturday, Diana was hitching a ride and David just happened to pick her up. Familiar with the park, he took the opportunity to drive her there, where he attacked her and left her body to be discovered by kids just out for a bike ride. I hope he is having the afterlife he deserves. Almost a year to the day after Shelley's murder, Lisa McCauley was killed on November 23rd, 1979. I have been digging and digging, and I just cannot find anything out about Lisa McCauley, who she was, where she was from, where she went to school, what she liked to do with her free time, what led to her being a sex worker. Sadly, I've been unable to find that information except for articles about her death. It was Thanksgiving afternoon when a woman was brought into the since-closed Holiday Park Hospital in Northeast Portland. She couldn't be identified right away as she was unconscious, and the beating she had taken to her head and face, I can only imagine how she looked as she came into the ER. The woman was eventually identified as 34-year-old Lisa McCauley, a known sex worker. Conveniently, the attack that sent Lisa to the hospital took place in broad daylight in the parking lot of a motel on Northeast 21st and Broadway in Portland. There were witnesses to the attack and they called for help. This allowed Lisa to get to the hospital as quickly as possible and for the man who was beating her to be arrested on the spot and charged with assault. Lisa fought hard, but she succumbed to her injuries 2 days later, being pronounced dead on Saturday the 25th. When Lisa died, her assailant, 34-year-old Robert Steve Moore, faced new charges. On Monday the 27th, Robert Moore was arraigned on the new charge of murder. He pleaded not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. He would have to wait until March for his trial. There was probably a sense of relief for Robert as he had just missed the window where his crimes would have made him eligible for the death penalty. Robert's day in court was almost literally that. The trial started on March 30th, and on April 3rd, after only an hour and a half of jury deliberations, he was found guilty of first-degree manslaughter. While I didn't read anything about what facts were presented by the defense to prove Robert wasn't in his right mind at the time of the attack, the state had plenty of evidence to counter it. The defense did offer one psychologist who stated Robert may have been acting under extreme emotional disturbance at the time of the murder. But the state brought in three psychiatrists and a clinical psychologist who countered that idea. It was also claimed that Robert could not have been suffering a severe emotional disturbance because at the time he was using heroin and Ritalin, both of which affect the level of trauma someone experiences. So basically, whatever was happening, he wouldn't have been affected by the trauma.
It's fuzzed out by the heroin.
Basically. Robert was considered or at least labeled as a transient and was living at the motel where the attack took place. The state's case was that Lisa and Robert were dating, although I did see documentation that she may have been married to someone else. Whatever their relationship was, it was more likely Robert had been Lisa's trafficker. That Thanksgiving afternoon, the state said that she was telling Robert she was leaving him, again, possibly romantically or in the business sense, to go work for another trafficker. As she left the room, he caught up to her in the parking lot. As witnesses confirmed, he hit and kicked her, stomping her head and neck into the pavement no less than 15 times. The state had five eyewitnesses who were at the Broadway Motel and saw the attack on Lisa. In that documentation, there was a reference to a curb, as in it's possible she was curb stomped. If that was the case, I really can't even fathom how she held on for 2 minutes, let alone 2 days after that. Once Robert was arrested at the scene, his violence continued. In custody, Robert acted out on at least 5 different occasions, assaulting guards and other inmates at the Rocky Butte Jail. He was described as violent and disruptive. There was even an incident that required 4 guards to restrain him. His behavior was so extreme, he was given a sedative before going to court. The only mental defect the judge declared was that Robert was, quote, a sociopath of the worst type. We'll give a good judge bell here, as an unusual decision was made regarding sentencing. Robert was convicted of first-degree manslaughter, which is a Class A felony with a maximum sentence of 20 years. Well, the judge was so disturbed by Robert's actions and lack of accountability, he added 10 years under Oregon's Dangerous Offender Act. This allows another decade to be pinned to a sentence if the defendant is found likely to commit future acts of violence and is therefore a danger to society. So in all, Robert was given 30 years with parole eligibility at 15, which, in my humble opinion, shouldn't really be an option if a judge has added time to the sentence because of how dangerous the offender was. But that's just me. Robert said it was his chronic drug use that led to his actions, saying, I didn't mean to do anyone any harm. There was, of course, an appeal. Robert's team claimed that because he was shackled during the trial, the jury was prejudiced into seeing him as a guilty criminal. The state argued that because of his constantly violent, uncontrollable, unpredictable behaviors, they had to keep him restrained for everyone's safety.
If you're going to poop in your pants, we got to put a diaper on you.
Thank you. That's a perfect analogy. The appeal court acknowledged that, yes, shackles can affect a jury, but their use is up to the judge's discretion. Because the trial judge had been informed about the incidents at the jail, he was well within his rights to leave Robert restrained. There was also an issue taken with the doctor who took the stand on Robert's behalf, but all in all, that appeal was rejected. I was unable to find a release date for Robert Moore, so I'm not sure if the parole board, our favorite folks, ignored the judge's request for him to be held longer than those 15 years and they released him in 1994 on parole, or if he served his full sentence and was released in 2009 at 64 years old. The good news is that I haven't read anything about him in the news since, so maybe he has been staying out of trouble. And now, if he is still around, he's maybe not as much of a danger to society at 80-something years old. Okay, I know this episode had a lot of information and a lot of names and a lot of different smaller stories. My reason for telling these cases together, even though they maybe aren't connected by a killer, is to counter what I'm kind of calling serial killer delight. So often online, I'll see people posting about current cases with a nearly bloodlust delight of like, oh my God, do you think there's a serial killer? Oh my gosh, do you think this is another serial killer in the area? As if having one dude with a weird or kinky MO is so thrilling and scary. Here's what's scary, that I have told all of these stories about sex workers and assumed sex workers who were killed within days and one a year later, and they were all by different men. That's a lot scarier to me that there would be that many individuals who are willing to harm someone with such disregard. And that's really much more horrifying than a single Ted Bundy. So that's why the ladies continue to choose the bear. We know it's not all men, but holy cow.
Yeah, it's not all men, but it is. It's all men that are doing it. Right.
Right. Yes. It's not all men, but it's all men. Yes, that's a good way to put that. It's hard to feel like there's not any justice here. So I'm just glad to finally get to share Tony's case. If I ever hear from any of those officers with any details, we will, of course, put those in an update. And I hope that that happens. I don't know who else of Tony's family is still around or in town. It'd be great to be able to give them something. Please share. You can always reach out to us about anything. We've had people reach out to us about information they don't want to share with police, and we've kept it anonymous or we've redirected them. So even if you're not sure what to do with information you have, we are always happy to help assist with that and redirect it. So do not hesitate to reach out, murderintherain@gmail.com, and we're happy to help. due to a concerned citizen who saw a suspicious. Very suspicious.
Because that, yeah,
yeah, it took that edge off.
Yeah, you were peeking a little
bit. I'm peeking. Oh, it's peeking season, Daddy. Do you like that?
No, because it sounded like you were wasting away to death.
Thank you.
Oh, Daddy.
So not
well,
my
I'm
favorite.
Sorry that my horny voice is also my catatonic voice.
Not my favorite role play.
Oh, and we love role play.
Oh, I'm a salesman. Well, I'm here to murder you.
And I'm saying Alameda, right? Right?
C.
Okay. Wait, there's a C in there? Alameda? Try Alameda today for all of your prostate problems. Side effects include gambling, horse riding,
prostate problems,
and depression,
peanut butter fixation.
Oh.
That's my band name.
That's a good one. Should we have children just so we can name them peanut butter brands?
I thought that was the plan.
Place in the quiet, two-laned suburb. Suburb? Local police and outreach workers took her paternity.